Your headlines for this hour: Iran's army says it has seized the Marshall Islands flagged oil tanker in the Gulf of Oman after the vessel collided with an Iranian boat. Hamas resistance movement condemns the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces, saying the resistance will continue until the regime is defeated. Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces agree to extend the ceasefire for 72 more hours as violence continues across the country. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. Iran's army says it has seized the Marshall Islands flagged oil tanker in the Gulf of Oman. The vessel collided with an Iranian boat, two crewmen have gone missing and several others have been injured. The army said naval forces seized the oil tanker upon attempts to, quote, flee despite international law obligations to help. The army says the tanker is now in the Islamic Republic's territorial waters. Reports say the oil tanker was heading to the U.S. city of Houston from Kuwait. Two Western organizations have called for a wider crackdown on Press TV social media, alleging that the network is spreading, quote, anti-Semitic views on the internet. The two groups claim Press TV is using social media to evade a broadcast ban to promote anti-Semitic content. They say the Iranian channel is also spreading conspiracy theories about Britain's Labour Party. They said the agenda is being pushed by Press TV's Palestine Declassified program. That's according to the UK-based Centre of Countering Digital Hate and the Anti-Defamation League, a Jewish organisation acting particularly in the United States as part of the Israel lobby. Press TV, whose motto is being the, quote, voice of the voiceless, has faced a host of restrictions on its activities since its inception in 2007. It has been dropped several times from cable or satellite platforms as well as social media networks. The EU, the US and the UK have imposed a wide array of sanctions on the channel. Press TV says the measures are part of a Western campaign of, quote, media terrorism against Iran. David Miller is a co-host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified program. He says this report is the latest part of Israel's campaign to close down anyone who stands up for the Palestinian cause.
This is a report which is part of a long-standing campaign against anyone who stands up for Palestine. And of course, I'm the producer of the show, and Chris Williamson, the former Labour MP who is the presenter, we have been attacked like this for many, many years now. But this is simply the latest element of those attacks. And in particular, they want to pressure the social media providers, Facebook and Twitter, and others, to remove or downgrade or to interfere with the reach that a show like Palestine Declassified gets. So they focus a lot in the report on our show Palestine Declassified. They have a lot of evidence in there where they say that we pursue particular lines of argument which are in some way anti-Semitic. And of course, all of that is nonsense. And I can talk much more about that. But what we're seeing here is the latest iteration of the Zionist regime's campaign worldwide to close down anyone who will stand up for Palestinian rights.
The Hamas resistance movement has condemned the killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces over an alleged stabbing attack. The Gaza-based movement said the resistance will continue until the regime is defeated, Palestine is liberated, and all prisoners are freed. 39-year-old Ahmad Yaqub Taha was fatally shot near the occupied West Bank city of Salafit. Contrary to the regime's stabbing claim, videos posted online show he was brutally shot after getting out of his car. Since last year, Israeli forces have stepped up violence against Palestinians across the occupied territories. The regime's forces have killed at least 100 Palestinians in the West Bank alone so far this year. A Palestinian official with the Islamic Jihad movement has warned Israel against assassination operations targeting resistance figures. The regime has repeatedly conducted raids into the West Bank in recent months. We earlier discussed the issue in our news review program.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. A senior Islamic Jihad official says the Palestinian resistance movement has a deal with Lebanon's Hezbollah to coordinate in response to potential attempts by Israel to assassinate resistance leaders. Walid al-Qutati made the remarks in relation to reports that the Israeli regime has embarked on its assassination policy against Palestinian officials. He said the resistance takes the current dynamic employed by the regime seriously. Qutati said the Palestinian resistance remains integrated in confronting Israel. The Palestinian official said the resistance is not to give in. Israeli forces have conducted numerous raids into the occupied West Bank in recent months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed so far this year. Khaled Barkat is a journalist and activist joining us from Ottawa, and we also have Mick Napier from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign who joins us from Edinburgh. Welcome, gentlemen. Khaled Barkat, I'll first start with you. When you take a look at the way that the resistance groups are making this announcement, it's in reaction to how Israel has made it public that it's going to assassinate resistance leaders, something that in the past it wouldn't think of doing, to put that out in the public domain. Why do you think Israel has done that, and what has pushed Israel to the point where it's intimidated and hence has made this type of an announcement?
Yes, thank you so much for the invitation. Well, we have to remember that assassination policy is a constant policy in the Zionist regime. The Israelis have always practiced assassination. In fact, before even the establishment of the Zionist regime, their terrorist organizations, their criminal groups have killed international convoys. And some of those people who were involved in these crimes are actually later on to become prime ministers and foreign ministers of Israel. Let's also remember that in the 60s, the then prime minister of the Zionist regime, Golda Meir, have something very famous that Palestinians remember called Golda Meir list. And what is this list is about is the list of names of Palestinians, intellectuals, scientists, novelists, poets, any Palestinian who were creative worldwide, or strategist or scientist. 40 of them were assassinated and killed in assassination campaigns by Israel. So the experience of the Palestinian people and the Arab people with this regime is that they have always used assassination policy to serve their interests. They also killed Iraqi scientists, Iranian scientists, Egyptian scientists. And what Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah, as leading forces of the resistance today, they understand that Israel also use assassination policy as a way out to solve its crisis. Although Israel understands that it can utilize these days this kind of policies in a war, a psychological war, event. And Hezbollah have especially a unique response and policy in terms of this. If we remember, for example, when Israel and the United States killed the leader of the Lebanese resistance, military resistance, Imad Mughniyeh, in Damascus, we saw the reaction of Hezbollah that Israel will pay a price. And it's still, until today, this is open, and Hezbollah keeps his options in terms of responding on the killing of Imad Mughniyeh and others.
Okay.
Let's just be one last sentence. Israel cannot carry assassination policies without the green light from Washington and the United States.
Well, the whole question here, Mick Napier, is why Israel is putting that out in the open. I mean, is that an open invitation that it's going to, I mean, one scenario is that it's going to go through and it's going to assassinate a resistance leader. Does it want, is it inviting for a military engagement with these groups, in particular, of course, Hezbollah being now united with the resistance leaders on this issue? Because after all, if this does happen, this could spell also a huge security threat for Israel itself.
Well, the whole point of terrorism is to try to terrorize. And this is an example of announcing to the world that they intend to kill Palestinians anywhere in the world where they can find them and want to kill them. It also does double service because watch the US response, and there will be no US response which says you cannot do this. They will find some form of words which allows Israel to do it. And also inside Israel itself, we're witnessing continuity from previous governments, but also something new. The continuity, of course, is the substantial rate of killing of Palestinians. But what's new is the style and the rhetoric which accompanies it. Previous Israeli regimes killed many thousands, but they tried to cover it up with honeyed words. This current government has created a base among the Israeli Jewish community which has a certain bloodlust. And really that bloodlust, the promises that were made to them for Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and Netanyahu to be re-elected and the other two to be elected, have to be paid back, and they pay it back in Palestinian blood. So it keeps their electoral base from deserting them for other elements, and as I say, it has to be paid in Palestinian lives. But it fits in, as our other guest has said eloquently, and he could have gone on for longer to talk about the terrible history of mass killings, but for Israel, their theory is very simple. They do not negotiate with the native people, with Palestinians, because they have a technological, military, and terror edge. And they can afford not to negotiate with the Palestinians because they can control them through their most advanced technology, which is, of course, enabled from America and the EU. So this real serious edge in delivering the means of violence has to constantly be renewed. And sometimes they are defeated. They were defeated in Lebanon in 2006. They were given a hiding by Hezbollah. They were not successful in their attempts to crush the Palestinian resistance in Gaza.
Sure. Thank you. Khaled Barkat, journalist and activist, McNapier, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have agreed to extend the ongoing ceasefire for 72 more hours as violence continues across the country. The Sudanese army had earlier given its initial approval to the extension, which was proposed by a regional African bloc. However, sporadic gunfire and airstrikes continued on the outskirts of the capital Khartoum and western Darfur region, despite the truce, which was due to expire on Thursday midnight. The U.S. has urged its citizens to leave the African country within 24 to 48 hours. The White House expressed concern on Wednesday over ceasefire violations, saying the situation could worsen at any moment. Several nations have already evacuated their citizens and diplomats from Sudan. More than 500 people have been killed and thousands injured since the fighting erupted in mid-April. Russia's drone industry could soon be worth 1 trillion rubles or over $12 billion once a plan to boost production is put into place. This is according to the Russian President Vladimir Putin.
A very important industry for the country to develop. Now my colleagues and I were just looking. I saw a drone figure. In the near future, the volume will become 500 billion rubles. But they immediately agreed with me that this is a very conservative estimate. Most likely, if we are all together, and the state too, we will work actively. It'll be a trillion rubles. It'll be such a volume.
Putin made the remarks after touring an industrial park in Moscow, which has been specially designed to manufacture drones. He added that drones could be used in virtually every part of the Russian economy. Last year, Putin ordered a strategy for drone development through 2030. The plan aims to increase Russia's drone output and create infrastructure for their widespread use in military and civilian sectors. According to Russian officials, the country should be able to make 18,000 drones a year by the end of 2026. There's apparently no let-up in the spate of industrial actions that have plagued the UK. This time, thousands of railroad workers have announced their plan to go on strike on May 13th. The National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers announced the decision after rail workers rejected the latest pay offer by train companies. The union said workers are left with no option but to continue their campaign for a negotiated settlement on pay, work conditions and job security. The train companies had offered a first-year pay rise of 5% if the RMT guaranteed that no further strikes could take place. The UK has seen a wave of industrial actions across various public and private sectors since last summer, with workers demanding inflation-matching pay rises. The country's inflation has hit a 40-year high of about 10%. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of school teachers in England have walked off their jobs once again in a long-running dispute with the British government over pay and funding. The strike action comes 3 weeks after members of the National Education Union that represents the teachers voted overwhelmingly to reject the government's offer that they said was insulting. A new report by a civil rights organization says hate crimes in the United States are likely to spike ahead of the 2024 election day. The Leadership Conference Education Fund says FBI data shows a clear pattern of a rise in hate crimes during general elections. The data suggests that from 2008, when Barack Obama, the first black American president in U.S. history, took office, hate crimes have been on the rise. The report says hate crimes have nearly doubled since 2015. It says a staggering spike came during and after Donald Trump's election campaign, and it has not returned to the levels before the Trump period. The civil rights group suggests that black people and Muslims are the main targets of hate crimes. Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new research has found that U.S. police sweeps of homeless encampments across the country have the potential to increase deaths among people who are unhoused by 25%. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, new research published by the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, finds that U.S. police sweeps of homeless encampments have the potential to increase deaths among people who are unhoused by 25% by 2028. On a single night in 2022, more than 500,000 people in the U.S. were unhoused. The research found, with black people and indigenous people experiencing homelessness at disproportionate rates, partially as a result of exorbitant housing prices and the U.S.'s often discriminatory housing market, the number of people experiencing unsheltered homelessness increased by 3% between 2020 and 2022. Jurisdictions have responded to this epidemic, brought on in large part by corporate greed and the real estate lobby, by instituting camping bans, city ordinances that make it a crime for any person to shelter themselves from the elements while residing on public or private property, effectively criminalizing homelessness. The National Homelessness Law Center, NHLC, the only national organization dedicated to using the U.S. legal system to end homelessness, reports that almost every state has at least one law restricting homeless people on the books, with four states restricting camping in public statewide and more than 100 jurisdictions criminalizing homeless encampments. Punitive policies like homeless sweeps aren't just cruel and ineffective, they also actively worsen the crisis, says Eric Tars, legal director for NHLC. When homelessness is effectively criminalized, unhoused people are burdened by arrest, jail time, and criminal records, making it even more difficult for them to access housing, social services, and employment. Homeless sweeps also threaten unhoused people's health, well-being, and connections to care, compromise personal safety and civic trust, and undermine paths to housing and financial stability, according to the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council. During encampment sweeps, police often seize, damage, or destroy items needed for survival, such as tents. These sweeps and the displacement that follows are traumatizing for people who are unsheltered, often exacerbating already existing mental conditions and pushing residents into more dangerous, isolated environments. U.S. police also frequently destroy life-saving medications and medical equipment, such as the overdose protection drug naloxone, that is Narcan, effectively contributing to overdose deaths. A stigma against drug use pushes people into isolation, and that's a recipe for unwitnessed overdose, said Yola Tepper, substance use specialist at the Knight Ministry in Chicago, adding, "When we take away encampments, we take away a community that can serve as a first line of defense against a potential death when an overdose happens." In the U.S., more than 30% of people who are experiencing homelessness also have a substance use disorder. Continual involuntary displacement through homeless encampment sweeps contributes to a 15-24% increase in deaths among unhoused people who use drugs. The study explains, involuntary displacement of people experiencing homelessness may substantially increase drug-related morbidity and mortality. These findings have implications for the practice of involuntary displacement, as well as policies such as access to housing and supportive services that could mitigate these harms. Sweeps, we predict, will contribute up to 25% of deaths among this population over a 10-year period. Dr. Joshua Barocas, principal investigator of the study and infectious disease doctor and associate professor at the University of Colorado, Medical Campus told Dana Reed, adding, "To put that a different way, it means our states and our cities in the U.S. are literally killing people with this." Meanwhile, U.S. News reported a new survey offers a grim picture of America's youth. Aside from fears of gun violence or homelessness, mental health remains a problem. Homelessness is a worry for young Americans, with nearly three-fourths, that is 73%, saying homelessness can happen to anyone, and nearly a third, about 32%, telling IOP pollsters that they are concerned they personally could become homeless one day. The survey offers a grim picture for an age cohort just beginning their adult lives. Aside from fears of having their lives cut short by gun violence or upended by homelessness, mental health remains a problem for American youth. The poll found nearly half, about 47% of the under 30s reported feeling down, depressed, or hopeless, and 24% said they had thoughts that they would be better off dead or had thought about hurting themselves for at least several days in the previous 2 weeks. And a first ever question about loneliness resulted in similarly disparaging results. 44% said they had been bothered by loneliness for at least several days in the previous few weeks. 46% reported little interest or pleasure in doing things. And 55% reported feeling nervous, anxious, or on edge.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and here is something short but sweet from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, to ponder upon. No one will find the true taste of faith before he refrains from telling lies, whether seriously or jokingly.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, submission to God. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being satisfied and submission to God in the Islamic lifestyle. When we are raising our children, when we talk about the nurturing or raising or tarbiyah in the Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary that we teach our kids how to be satisfied in their life and how to submit to God. Because this satisfaction and submission is important, and it is important that they know that what is actually being satisfied means. Being satisfied, content, happy, what does it mean? And how can a person be when a person is the servant of God? What does it mean? It means that when we say that someone is feeling content, someone is satisfied, it means that he is satisfied to what Allah has said for him. The commands of God that are been there, he perform or he lives according to those commands. And he stops himself from the prohibited things, the prohibitions, the things that are the are haram, the things that are being said that you cannot perform it. And therefore, when he stops himself from those things, when he stops himself from the prohibited things in the Islam, this is where he shows that I'm satisfied of what you had made halal for me. And this is very important that we teach our children to consume the halal things, to live a halal life, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of satisfied and submission to God in the Islamic lifestyle. It is necessary that we teach our kids how to be satisfied, and being satisfied means that we leave or we do not go towards the prohibited things, the prohibitions and the things which are haram. And we live a halal life. On the other hand, the submission to God means that we accept all the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala without any condition. We cannot put any condition on God. I cannot say because there is a hot weather, so I will not wear the hijab, for example. I cannot say that because it is too hot, I will not fast in the month of Ramadan. Or maybe in the morning it is hard for me to wake up, therefore I will not offer the Fajr prayer. So without any condition, I need to accept whatever it's been said by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because he has set a halal life for me, this halal life, this life which I'm going to have, the Islamic lifestyle, it is the means of getting the perfection. It is means to go towards the perfection and to achieve the perfection. And once I achieve the perfection, there are high ranks for me. There is a satisfaction, an inner peace for me when I live according to the commands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when I stop myself from going towards the prohibited things or the prohibited actions. It means that it provides me an inner peace, which is the satisfaction, which is the submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is something which I need to get. And this is what we need to teach our kids, to reach to this perfection, to reach to this peace, to have a good Islamic lifestyle, inshallah, through this. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Treaty between Iran and Afghanistan.
Part 2.
Mohammad Musa Shafiq, Prime Minister of Afghanistan, and Amir Abbas Hoveida, Prime Minister of Iran, with the presence of both delegations, negotiated at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at 4:30 p.m. on March 21st. They expressed their readiness to sign and conclude the treaty and two attached protocols. The Helmand Water Treaty was signed by the delegations of Iran and Afghanistan. Mohammad Musa Shafiq, Prime Minister of Afghanistan, and Amir Abbas Hoveida, Prime Minister of Iran, signed the texts of the Helmand River Water Treaty and two attached protocols in the Palace of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, March 22, 1973.
If politics is a field of power for those who are involved in it, it may be a realm of love and hate for the people of a country. Just like the rule of the chess game, sometimes the decision of a politician can wipe him out from the scene. This is a historic treaty in the relations between Iran and Afghanistan. Mohammad Musa Shafiq, then Prime Minister of Afghanistan, was executed a few years after signing the Helmand Water Treaty. The decision to execute a senior Afghan political official based on the book Afghanistan in the last five centuries was mostly influenced by the water treaty with Iran, and Mohammad Musa Shafiq played the role of a traitor for the coup plotters. But the Hamun wetland has become drier by the day during these years. The Hamun wetland dryness has had many effects on the ecosystem of people in Sistan and Balochistan. This issue has complicated the livelihood of about 500,000 people in this province. My experience with the Taliban says that this delay is continuous, so I have to do something. I use one of these rooms as my workroom. One morning, I heard the Taliban release water to Iran via the Kamal Khan Dam, but no one in Sistan and Balochistan confirms this news. Publishing the news of water release into Iran has negative reactions in Afghanistan's social networks. Taliban have been accused of treason. In just a few hours, the Taliban deny releasing water to Iran and announce it for Afghan farmers. This retreat from the work done revives Mohammad Musa Shafiq's memory, the prime minister whose water treaty with Iran caused his execution. He studied in Egypt and America and was a minister of foreign affairs before becoming the prime minister. His coming to power as the prime minister is also related to the water issue. At the same time as Mohammad Musa Shafiq took office in 1973, the security situation in Afghanistan was chaotic due to the activity of Maoist communist currents.
Actually, what he wanted to, and what I wanted to do here is, has been a great deal of publicity.
As Prime Minister, Mohammad Musa Shafiq tried to change Afghanistan's foreign policy from the Soviet Union towards Western countries and its allies. Iran, Afghanistan's Western neighbor, is one of America's allies.
In welcoming you to the United States.
In the first step, Mohammad Musa Shafiq paid attention to Iran to resolve the long-standing dispute that existed due to disputes over water. On the other side of the border, the Shah of Iran is not satisfied with this treaty, but the Americans convinced the Shah to accept this agreement by exaggerating the danger of communism. Finally, in 1973, Mohammad Musa Shafiq signed the Helmand River Water Treaty with his Iranian counterpart, Amir Abbas Hoveyda. According to the provisions of this contract, it was decided that 26 cubic meters of water per second is equivalent to 850 million cubic meters per year would be Iran's share of water from the Kajaki Dam. Mohammad Musa Shafiq is accused of treason in the public opinion because of this agreement, but finally, the Treaty on Sharing the River's Water was approved and finalized by the Afghan Parliament in 1973. After this treaty, Mohammad Zahir Shah traveled to Italy. He was relieved for sharing the river's waters between Iran and Afghanistan. During this trip, he learns about the coup against his kingdom. Mohammad Daoud Khan is a pioneer of the coup d'etat. He is one of the main opponents of the Helmand River Water Treaty. In 1937, after the emergence of a new Afghan government, the approval of the Helmand River Water Treaty with Iran is postponed. This decision is the beginning of an era in which the war begins in Afghanistan for four decades, and there will be no stable government in this country. After several decades, the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, used the experience of previous officials, shows his power over water, and speaks about the water treaty with Iran at the opening ceremony of the Kamal Khan Dam. The reflection of Ashraf Ghani's speech in the media is interpreted as he was discourteous to Iran. But the Iranian Foreign Ministry stand refers to the 1973 Helmand Water Treaty. But in this instance, there's no news of condemnation. nor is there any mention of the Kamal Khan Dam. That's why Ashraf Ghani expresses his satisfaction with it a day later. Despite the fact that I have limitations at Nimruz Palace, I try to make contact with water resource specialists in Iran using the internet. Sometimes there are power outages in Afghanistan. There is no electricity in many provinces of the country for many long hours. Because Nimruz is close to the Iranian border, there is no power outage at all. I call one of the local journalists to find out about the situation inside the country. Can't understand what he really means. So I go to my workroom to see the map and then listen to him explaining the route of water from the Kamal Khan Dam into Iran. According to Mr. Dahmarde, Jarike is the first point of entrance of Helmand's water into Iran. I asked to go to Jarike so we could have a video call. Ask a group to talk about this matter with experts in Tehran. I had to do it because I had a bad experience with a power outage when I ran out of battery. Amir Asadollah Alam was the Prime Minister and Minister of the Royal Court of the Pahlavi period. He was an influential person in the royal court and one of the closest people to Mohammad Reza Shah. Sir Dennis Wright, the former British ambassador to Iran, believed that Amir Asadollah Alam was the most influential person in the royal court. He mentions the hands of the invisible master in his memoirs. One of these mediators is John Leyland. John Gallup Leyland was a Jewish American who worked closely with the CIA, a man in the shadows. The connection between Leyland's family and Iran continues later. Years later, John Leyland's son, David Leyland, tries to get in touch with people in Iran as an intelligence officer in American security projects. In the situation that the Iranian Foreign Ministry's answer is negative about the agreement, this agreement is signed with John Leyland's lobbies. Based on the documents that were published later, Alan Dulles, the 5th United States Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, thanked John Leyland for his service to the United States. One of the problems of the treaty is that it does not clearly mention the environmental water rights of the Hamun wetland. More important than the water right issue is that the Kamal Khan Dam was built by Ashraf Ghani in such a way that the water inside it flows to the Guadzare salt marsh. This means the diversion of an official river, the consequences of which are, first of all, water wastage, and secondly, depriving Iranian and Afghan farmers of water on both sides of the border.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Russian tycoon says that dollar has 5 years left as dominant currency. Sanctioned businessman Oleg Deripaska says the greenback has been used as a weapon of retribution for way too long. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the US dollar has only 5 years left as the principal currency for the global economy, according to Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska. He claims the greenback superiority has for way too long been used as a weapon of vengeance against all dissenters, and often without prior legal evaluation. 7 years ago, the absolute dominance of the greenback in global settlements and financial transactions seemed unshakable. The founder of aluminum giant Rusal wrote in a Telegram post recently. Deripaska expects global settlements to become more diversified and for digital currencies to become more compatible. He said, "That will be hard at the beginning, but then the world will discover a new reality without a need for a hegemon." Recently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen admitted that Washington's unilateral sanctions on countries around the world could undermine the hegemony of the dollar. However, a year ago, she claimed the opposite, saying that the greenback didn't have any serious competition and was not likely to for a long time. Earlier this month, Ivan Chebeskov, who leads the Financial Policy Department at Russia's Financial Ministry, said that interruptions and difficulties with international settlements became the most painful consequences of Western sanctions for the Russian financial system. He also highlighted that at the same time, the problem had inevitably triggered an increase in settlements in alternative currencies. In February, the Central Bank of Russia created a special department for handling issues arising in international settlements. The new body deals with the challenges that have become particularly relevant in the context of sanctions, such as the transition to settlements in national currencies. Deripaska is among many Russian businessmen sanctioned in the past year by the U.S. in response to Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. He was forced out as CEO of Rusal after Washington targeted the company's aluminum exports. He's worth $2.6 billion, according to Forbes. Meanwhile, Press TV noted U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has admitted that economic sanctions used against countries by the U.S. put the dollar's dominance at risk. As the United States has continued to weaponize the dollar, countries are seeking alternatives, from creating new common currencies to using local currencies. Nations are trying to find a safe and equitable way to trade instead of being at the whims of a hegemony that can decide overnight to confiscate a country's money or cut it off from the international financial system. Russia launched its de-dollarization policy when the West slapped economic sanctions against the country. After Russia launched its special operation in eastern Ukraine in February 2022, the U.S. led a massive wave of financial sanctions against Moscow. Press TV noted the biggest moves were the decision by the West to freeze nearly half of Russia's foreign currency reserves and also the removal of major Russian banks from SWIFT, an interbank messaging service that facilitates international payments. The backdrop of the sanctions introduced by Western regimes against Russia, a major global energy producer and exporter, prompted China to decide to ditch the dollar in international trade as well. Bank of Russia records show that the Chinese yuan has become a major player in Russian foreign trade. India, a major importer of Russian energy, has also taken several steps towards shifting away from the greenback to rubles and rupees in mutual trade with Moscow.
Weapons never stopped firing. These children are victims of a war that ended over half a century ago. Landmines and explosive remnants of war are the cursed inheritance left to them by war.